The planet Mars, I scarcely need remind the reader, revolves about the Sun at a mean distance of 140 million miles, and the light and heat it receives from the Sun is barely half of that received by this world. It must be, if the nebula hypothesis has any truth, older than our world. And long before this Earth ceased to be molten, life upon its surface must have begun its course. The fact that it is scarcely 1/7 of the volume of the Earth must have accelerated its cooling to the temperature at which life could begin. It has air and water and all that is necessary for the support of animated existence. Yet, so vain is man, and so blinded by his vanity, that no writer, up to the very end of the 19th century, expressed any idea that intelligent life might have developed there far, or indeed at all, beyond its earthly level. Nor was it generally understood that since Mars is older than our Earth, with scarcely a quarter of the superficial area and remoter from the Sun, it necessarily follows that it is not only more distant from time's beginning, but nearer its end. A couple of paragraphs taken from the opening chapter of War of the Worlds, in which we begin to start exploring this nature of what I refer to as proto-science fiction, with particular reference to late Victorian and Edwardian science fiction tropes. Arguably, science fiction started with Mary Shelley when she constructed Frankenstein, also known as the modern Prometheus, back in the 1815 period. But 85 years later, or thereabouts, Wells produced War of the Worlds, part of a prolific series, a quartet of novels that in many ways serve as the foundation and building blocks for contemporary science fiction. The others being The Time Machine, The Island of Dr. Moreau, and The Invisible Man. Clearly, he became an acknowledged writer after those particular books were published, and maintained his position until pretty much the 1930s, 1940s. But what was he actually effectively looking to develop? And what are we going to explore in this particular sequence? Well, you could say it was a precursor to steampunk, and the sort of elements that came out of extraordinary voyages and a whole variety of exciting times. This was a period where Britain was very much at the height of empire. It was the empire on which the sun never set. And in terms of the experience of your average British citizen, it was one in which we were very much at the top of the tree. So why would Herbert George Wells, there he is, actually want to start thinking about what would happen in the event of an invasion, in the event of a colonizing force? Why use speculative fiction as a mode to actually begin to unpick some of the key elements that he really wanted to address within society? Science fiction, and in many ways this can be said of much literature, reflects the period that it's being produced in. A good technique to actually employ when you're analysing science fiction texts is look at the culture and the historical events that are happening when it's emerging. I've already said that this was a period where, as far as Britain was concerned, it was very much a forward-thinking, dynamic country at the top of its game. And yet history had kind of revealed a number of sort of key elements in terms of how things were being developed, so that as we reach the fin de siècle, the end of the century, and we reach this period of 1895, when these texts begin to start working through it, clearly there are other influences at work. And Wells, being a writer, inevitably is going to be influenced to a certain extent by them. There is one of the key writers who kind of would sit in the notion of travels, voyages. A very prolific French author, probably best known these days for Around the World in 80 Days, 2,000 Leagues Under the Sea, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, and a variety of other sort of areas as well, Jules Verne. Many of his books are effectively sort of out of print, but still accessible. And there's a gentleman who latterly kind of impacted in terms of the sort of influence that Wells might have been working through, Edgar Rice Burroughs. creator, amongst other things, of Tarzan, but also in the early part of the 20th century of John Carter of Mars. It's interesting in terms of how they could have influenced each other in terms of thoughts that were being put together. But what are some of the key tropes that we deal with when you start talking about how Wells puts this into play within War of the Worlds and within science fiction in general? In other words, if I was to do a survey of everybody in this hall at present and say how many people actually could identify science fiction, what are the characteristics which would come through? Well, there's number one. We are not the same people we were when I started this lecture a few moments ago. We've inevitably changed. Seconds have passed by. The constant now is always changing. We are moving forward. But then every time you actually pick up a text, every time you pick up a book, every time you pick up a tablet, you're effectively accessing somebody's thoughts and travelling back in time with them. You know, English is one of those wonderful topics in which you can genuinely engage with the past and the present and the future in terms of thought experiments, the kind of constant simultaneity that actually occurs, all things occurring at the same time. It's a theory that cosmologists have talked about at length, emerging from superstring theory and so on, that actually at this moment, not only are you sitting in this lecture theatre, you're also being born, you're dying, you're having families, all these things are happening simultaneously. It's just because we have the illusion of time being a kind of linear notion that we can work around that. There's one of the interesting lines that starts addressing time travel, obviously an American writer, but he starts talking about the Egyptian notions and the elements with respect to that. William Morris, likewise, a key early precursor. It's wrong to actually turn around and say science fiction began with H.G. Wells. No, it didn't. I've already said Shelley had an input in terms of where things were going. But also lots of other writers were developing these scientific romances, as they came to be known. The analysis of how we actually can engage in the pleasure of saying what would happen if. Fundamental to so much science fiction is those two words, what if, a kind of line of where things are actually going and developing. And as you can see, all of these sort of areas are written prior to Wells writing his own Time Machine and then The War of the Worlds and so on. Samuel Clemens, writing of course as Mark Twain in A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. The trouble is very much in the mind. The lead character effectively is knocked unconscious and wakens in a time which he perceives as very much the time of King Arthur, Camelot, and so on. And it's the interconnectivity between how he relates to times past from the contemporary perspective that is the classic fish-out-of-water scenario that Twain addresses and so on. And then, of course, as I say, Wells, before the War of the Worlds, just before, emerges with the Time Machine. This traveller who effectively proves that there is another dimension that we can travel in. And in so many ways, you could argue that that sense of an Edwardian gentleman in a device that nobody quite understands that can travel through space and time is very much a precursor for a BBC series which launched in 1963 and 54 years later is still going today as incarnated by... I was going to see Stephen Moffat, and of course he's heading off now, Chris Chibnall and others. Doctor Who is, of course, the line in question. And then, as I say, kind of further influenced by Wells's work, London's The Star Rover in 1950 is also sort of a line that addresses that. So time travel is one of those key aspects. The other popular trope that's particularly impressive at this period of time is the notion that within our very planet, we have other civilizations that exist. One of the aspects of living in an age of rationalization, an age of scientific enlightenment, is that not only can you actually provide evidence or see evidence and discover evidence of previous civilizations, you also start discovering things such as dinosaurs, translated literally as terrible lizards. These huge creatures that existed long before humanity even began to emerge as a serious competitor and a serious resident of the planet Earth, giving rise to the classic notion that civilizations will rise, the wheel will turn, and civilizations will fall. And why shouldn't those civilizations, in possibly the case of Atlantis, which had been echoed as far back as the writings of Plato, have simply actually taken residence inside the Earth? What happens within the Earth scenario? What takes place in inner space and so on? Verne, again, very much at the forefront of that with his Journey to the Centre of the Earth, 1864 opus. So we're dealing with travel not only through time, but also through space. And in this particular aspect, journeys into inner space. The best way to appreciate Samuel Butler's attempt at this whole thing is to reverse the letters. So as opposed to air one, literally nowhere. Reverse it around. It's a bit like Utopia, as written by Thomas More. This notion of no place. It's a kind of exercise in imagination, suggesting what would happen in a particular place and what adventures or things would occur within that whole field. Harbin likewise. Some of these authors still resonate, some of them are kind of lost to the mists of antiquity and so on, and emerge possibly on an annual basis for a session within Edwardian literature and so on. So that's the second of these sort of key things that works through. And again, within the Hollow Earth, the line is that you would have a more advanced civilization, which Wells alludes to in that opening sequence that I read to you a few seconds ago, that has been here long before we existed. And there is this conceit that somehow humanity can believe that we're at the top of the evolutionary tree, where effectively we may just be a small part of that tree. It's the kind of mindset, ultimately, we could say, that used to exist pre-Galileo, pre-Copernicus, where the official line was that the Earth was at the centre of the universe. It had to be. The Sun revolved around the Earth, didn't it? Until it was proven that actually it wasn't. Likewise, the Earth had to be flat. You look at the horizon, you keep on going down the horizon, you'll fall off the edge. How do we actually develop that whole notion? So it's a conceptual paradigm which starts opening up people's appreciation of where we are, what we're doing, and so on. Part of the pleasures, really, of science fiction is working on this basis of, you know, what we're doing, considering other alternative states of being, alternative histories, alternative realities, some which might be better than we are currently experiencing, some which might be far worse. So you get a classic binary opposition between the line, as I often say, that one person's utopia can be another person's dystopia. The notion that we're living in paradise can equally be contradicted by the fact, no, we're not, we're living in an Orwellian totalitarian state nightmare. So again, clearly we've got these elements that come through, which certainly emerge very much not only through the 20th century and 21st century, but also in terms of Bellamy's work looking backward, and Dean and Howell's Travel from Alshuria. That's quite apart from, as I say, the 15th century Thomas More text and so on. What I'm trying to indicate in this opening sort of sequence is that there are an awful lot of writers and publishers and thinkers who've been kind of addressing some of the ideas that Wells himself will come to synthesize. Now, Wells was lower middle class. He was an individual who was effectively, obviously, looking to better himself in keeping with the Victorian tradition. And he would sit in on lectures at the National History Museum at Imperial College. He would soak up the thoughts and thinking and the philosophies of ideas that would be coming through, as well as being quite a voracious reader. And again, developing an appreciation for what is being written, how things are developing, and so on. So his familiarity with this fourth of the kind of key areas here, you know, adding to utopia, dystopia, the Hollow Earth scenario and time travel, etc., of the future. Strange worlds, seeking out new frontiers, boldly going, etc. Gulliver's Travels could, on one sense, not only be considered a Georgian satire, but also a work of science fiction. Lemuel Gulliver actually, you know, travels to a range of different environments, different worlds, from the Lilliputians to the Brobdingnagians, and so on, the Hoonihans, all strange, peculiar ways. Or are we also using these worlds to comment on society in a kind of metaphor or allegory? You know, we could write a companion text now, say Paris in the 22nd century.
where would we actually go? What would we consider?
How things would it be developed, as Vernon was talking about Paris in the 20th century, back in the 19th century? And the notion of, literally, there may be other beings existing amongst us that we just can't see, we can't perceive. Again, this is a period where other key elements are emerging. The telegraph, huge invention. This ability to actually communicate not just from different towns, but from different countries. And so there's a lot of discussion at this particular time about if you can communicate with somebody who is in Washington, D.C., America, from London, England. That's over huge distances. What about if people have actually passed on to another dimension, communicating with the dead? And spiritualism is a key element that also grows here in terms of becoming a highly popular notion of how people can relate. You know, what's the connection between etheric energy? The electric light bulb, phenomenal invention. How does it work? How do we control that energy? How do we work through that? This notion that science is progressing forward and technologically we are improving our existence as a result of that. But then, as Ian Forster also wrote, sometimes, you know, there are problems. What would happen now if literally all oil stopped working? That fuel that fuels so many sort of travel-based things, so people couldn't actually get home, they couldn't move, you know, we had complete blackout. How do we actually connect from that perspective? In other words, it's the catastrophe. My colleague Catherine Redpath actually does a superb level 2 module called After the End, which focuses very much on the dystopian world and this worldview of saying, actually, maybe the future is going to be dystopian. Maybe it is going to be terrifying. You know, whether it's a case of natural catastrophes, whether it's a case of catastrophes of our own making, the cleverness of man will be the ruination of man, and so on. Even Shelley actually got in on the act. A text that she is probably less well known for other than Frankenstein, but again starts talking very much about the whole essence of the end of days, the end of time, where things are coming from, how things are developing, etc. And, you know, as Donnelly actually noted in terms of Ragnarok, that in itself is echoing Norse mythology and the end of times, the end of days, and the end of the gods, and so on. Okay, so moving on from that sort of particular aspect, let's consider some of the other social and political revolutions that are actually occurring. A cursory reading of Wells's writing will suggest great ideas, very poor characterization. The role of women in Wells's stories is, frankly, very weak at best. They're not strong characters. We don't see any sense of equality. Unusual, because Wells was actually quite an advocate for equality. Maybe he felt, or his publisher felt, that the readership weren't quite willing to take the notion of equality, and certainly it wasn't until the 1920s that the suffragette movement effectively led to women getting the vote, for example. And that required a world war, the Great War, to obviously sort of impact it, and arguably, again, there's still sort of challenges being faced with respect to that. In terms of the colonies, there's still this sense that France and Britain would slice open huge chunks of the world. So in the case of France, you would probably look to what latterly became Vietnam, Cambodia, French Indochina, as it was referred to. Africa, obviously, is fair game. And there is that sort of sense of missionary zeal that needs to obviously be converted. And looking further back, we already had evidence of what had happened in South America, and indeed North America, when a more advanced, technologically advanced, group of citizens effectively began to colonize those particular areas. The end of the Aztecs, the end of the Mayans, and in the case of Native America, clearly the end of the Native American ownership or existence and their lifestyle and so on. Not least of which is, of course, the American Civil War, which took place between 1861 and 1865. So again, that whole notion of the battling for the abolition of slavery.
So a number of sort of key elements are actually occurring here, taking on board that line I mentioned about where things are going, how things are being developed, and how Wells will be influenced and impacted by, right, as an element with that. Conrad effectively went on, obviously, to do Heart of Darkness. Okay. So, still talking about narrative tropes, still talking about ways in which things are forward. For every sociological initiative that occurs, there's also a corresponding notion of, well, let's just engage in that thought experiment. Let's sort of deal with the notion of, it's fun. Why do people like science fiction? You know, why did we have a symposium a week on Sunday which kind of addressed the whole notion of scientific romances and so on? Because it is fun. There's an intrinsic pleasure in terms of saying, well, actually, we can have a whole variety of key things within that whole system. We can actually talk about science as a dominant narrative trope, and it can actually improve ourselves. Wells was very much a passionate believer in suggesting that the country would be far better if, rather than having elected politicians, we had a group of science-trained individuals who would effectively democratically and despotically, that's not too much of a contradiction in terms, begin to rule and guide people into the future, because science was good. You know, you need to actually know that it's not simply because the gods are angry when illness or indeed environmental catastrophes strike and so on. In terms of writing and in terms of literature, generally, as far as scientific romances are concerned, it was a 60-year period at which it existed. And you have three or four distinctive areas where science fiction grows and develops, from the point of view of Wells, the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century, to John W. Campbell and the pulp fiction era within the United States between 1920 to 1940, and then some more hard scientific writings of Arthur C. Clarke, Isaac Asimov and others, writing sort of lastly in the 1960s, more cultural upsurge and change, and then of course the 1980s, the cyberpunk movement. That's a compressed version of what, if you choose to actually take my science fiction option level 3, we'll sort of focus on more coherently. Although better known for the line, The Witch in the Wardrobe, Lewis was probably, again, another one of those characters who would kind of engage in this whole notion when he wasn't battling with Tolkien and the Inklings to develop various other factors. I've already mentioned The Good Doctor, and of course steampunk. These are all, in a sense, Wells's descendants, the sort of things that emerged from the War of the Worlds elements and so on. So, 22 minutes in, let's consider the War of the Worlds. Let's actually sort of go on to consider the notion of where this was actually taken from and how Wells effectively was addressing the whole essence of the structure. Well, we've talked a little bit about sort of readers, and we talked about the notion of being very much at the peak of empire and so on. But this is something which I think often needs to be addressed and looked at in slightly more detail, because it's this whole notion of colonies and colonists that we actually sort of see developed within that whole sort of sequence. Chapter 11. I've already said that my storms of emotion have a trick of exhausting themselves. After a time, I discovered that I was cold and wet, and with little pools of water about me on the stair carpet. I got up almost mechanically, went into the dining room and drank some whiskey, and then I was moved to change my clothes. After I'd done that, I went upstairs to my study, but why I did so, I do not know. The window of my study looks over the trees and the railway towards Horsell Common. In the hurry of our departure, this window had been left open. The passage was dark, and by contrast with the picture, the window frame enclosed, the side of the room seemed impenetrably dark. I stopped short in the doorway. The thunderstorm had passed. The towers of the Oriental College and the pine trees about it had gone, and very far away, lit by a vivid red glare, the common about the sandpits was visible. Across the light, huge black shapes, grotesque and strange, moved busily to and fro. It seemed indeed as if the whole country in that direction was on fire. A broad hillside set with minute tongues of flame, swaying and writhing with the gusts of the dying storm and throwing a red reflection upon the cloud scud above. Every now and then a haze of smoke from some nearer conflagration drove across the window and hid the Martian shapes. I could not see what they were doing, nor the clear form of them, nor recognise the black objects they were busied upon. Neither could I see the nearer fire, though the reflections of it danced on the wall and ceiling of the study. A sharp, resinous tang of burning was in the air. Is it the destiny of natural selection, that key Darwinian theory, which was emerging again as the classic sort of theoretical and scientific sort of analysis of the late 19th century, which leads to this survival of the fittest? You know, that's the way nature works. That people who are best adapted to change will survive it. Life form species that are best adapted will survive. And if you don't survive, clearly you will become extinct. Darwin himself had actually taken his own voyage, his journey to the Galapagos Islands, the voyage of the Beagle. And clearly that's one of the elements where the strange creatures from the Galapagos tortoises through to the chaffinches and finches and so on, a kind of impact on this whole notion of minds immeasurably superior to ours regarded this earth with envious eyes. This sense that somehow humanity, the earth, was being watched by its neighbour until, of course, the time came for the invasion, or indeed the colonisation, to take place. And wrapped into all of that, you've got the sense of the alien as the other. The alien as part human, inhuman, recognising what we are as human beings by contrasting with what we are not. Whether you look at contemporary incarnations such as the Predator series, the Ridley Scott Alien series and so on, this strange sort of notion of technological aliens who are so far advanced that they've got increasing technology, but they are different from ourselves. And again, it's a standard line that humanity doesn't really relate well to differences. It's often said that the best way to guarantee uniformity amongst the races and classes of the planet Earth would be to have an alien invasion. As we said, first contact scenarios usually don't go down that well. Even James Cook was killed by the Hawaiian tribe after ostensibly making peaceful contact with a variety of other sort of areas. And as we've already said, in terms of the South America tradition, etc., there's lots of sort of stories and narratives of how, you know, this challenge of first contact can be very difficult. It's one of the reasons why Gene Roddenberry introduced, in terms of the Star Trek series, the aspects of the Prime Directive, not actually sort of making contact until people feel that they're ready to do so. It's important to also note that science fiction does tend to reflect a culture when it's progressing. You're seeing currently a huge growth in science fiction writing in China, not disconnected with its growth as a technological superpower. For a considerable number of decades, science fiction was actually banned in China as a way of sort of being as not being appropriate and not being worthwhile considering and so on. But there was a significant sort of time at the start of this century where it was felt that in order to take that leap forward in terms of technological developments, you needed to develop and fuel the imagination. And that's one of the reasons why a lot of science fiction writers tends to be Western-based, and obviously America, Britain, Europe, tying into that whole field. I said that you could draw a connection between The Time Machine, The Invisible Man, Island of Dr. Moreau, and War of the Worlds by almost being analogous to adenine, guanine, thymine, and cytosine, the four basic DNA building blocks of life. And you could also say that, in terms of this, what you got are building blocks of a lot of contemporary science fiction. And I've already talked about how he was very much influenced by Darwin and his theory of that, but also why Mars? Why Mars as opposed to a made-up planet, or a hollow Earth, or Jupiter, or Saturn, or Pluto, or any of those sort of areas? Well, of course, Percival Lowell and indeed various Italian astronomers had already been able to observe Mars. They'd already been able to see what may have been and could have been, albeit wrongly interpreted, as canals, as evidence of a civilization being there. And it's a really impactful way in which you can imprint and embed your narrative within sufficient realistic science to make it appear real. Otherwise, you could argue it's just fantasy. There is a line that Arthur C. Clarke uses, which is quite an interesting one, which suggests that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. But in the same way, let's break it down a little bit more. If you're writing scientific fiction and a scientific romance, it's a really effective way of not only using some of the evolutionary ideas that are in the public vogue with, as I say, the astronomical scenario. Hence the reason you clearly have got a whole range of genetic engineering novels and texts that come through in the latter part of the 20th century, from Margaret Atwood, Handmaid's Tale, right the way through, or right the way back to Brave New World and so on. Lots of sort of areas that connect within that whole field. The two excerpts that I've read, and hopefully you've all had a chance to read the book itself, you pretty much do it over a couple of evenings, I would have thought, is very much presented as a factual account. It's written as a first-person singular narrative. It's developing the reader and bringing the reader in from the basis of this is actually happening. This is the development of how things go right the way up through to the final denouement and the development of that. So the tension, the fears, the anxieties, the characterizations of the soldier, the characterizations of the weapons armies, etc., all interconnected with this factual element of the writer. It's the case of Wells there. Already spoken about the fact that characterization is not strong. But then, one of the elements within science fiction is that maybe it doesn't need to be hugely strong. And maybe the ideas are more important. Again, that's open to debate and discussion. Is it dystopian in nature? Well, yes, it is. And again, anecdotally, Wells was apparently walking through Surrey one day, and he thought, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could actually just see war machines destroying this whole area? So great opportunity to kind of describe his own sort of home counties as kind of being obliterated by the Martian death rays and the impacts with respect to that. You know, blowing things up, it's not just the catastrophe movies of the current period that sort of connect in terms of that. And equally, the notion of, well, it's only a novel, it's all okay, and the fact that clearly at the end we can sort of re-emerge is fine. It's part of, again, almost a sub-genre of invasion fiction. You know, what happens when you do get a sort of notion of alien invaders, tying in all the other sort of fears and aspects? Arguably, one of the kind of concerns is, of course, clearly, Wells was so effective in developing this that in 1938, the War of the Worlds radio broadcast panicked America when the namesake Orson Welles, no relation to H.G., effectively did a radio dramatization of War of the Worlds, which, again, was using the same sort of narrative style, but done in a sort of contemporary routine. Again, that fear of invasion, which, of course, would be manifested as well in terms of the actual invasions that occurred in both world wars of the 20th century and so on. A little bit of background there, just to actually have a look through from that perspective. And I think the key thing to emerge from that is that, as we said, ultimately, we're spending a period of time now considering the work of Wells and analysing it and so on, but he was a jobbing writer. He wanted to actually get paid for what he was actually doing. And although this was his fourth novel, on the success of The Time Machine and so on, it was published initially as a serial. One in which you'd actually have those cliffhanger endings, kind of classic way of, to be continued previously on. You'd have a whole range of other elements that would work through that. Incidentally, it's not the contemporary Cosmopolitan magazine, in case you're thinking, oh, Cosmopolitan, you did H.G. Wells? No, different magazine, that's the United States version, etc. Pearson's was a very popular serialization, amongst other things. Also sort of looks to follow in the footsteps of obviously the works of Arthur Conan Doyle, Sherlock Holmes and various other sort of elements. And I think one of the key areas that also ties in with this, some of the other writers that we've spoken about dealt with conflict from within, conflict within the earth, etc. But what Wells really managed to tap into was this is humanity and extraterrestrials. People who were from beyond planet Earth that actually sort of operated in their own particular area and so on. It's one of the reasons why there are clearly two distinct parts, not only in this but also in the Jeff Wayne's adaptation of the whole thing. You have that initial scene setting of how the Martians arrive and so on, and then of course the Red Earth, the colonisation, and then of course the way in which we give thanks for the little things, the bugs and so on that work through that basis. And ultimately, if you're kind of summing up some of the key aspects that we actually have within this whole field, the Boer War, obviously based in Africa, was very much at the heart of all sorts of things. This whole notion of invading and taking over a particular land is in vogue. But equally, you've got those three aspects. And if I was asked to really sort of say, all right, sum up three key distinctive elements that Wells kind of taps into, it would very much be the focus on British imperialism. Again, something which within Wells' lifetime was to change substantially. And other writers like Rudyard Kipling, of course, who were very passionate pro-British Empire supporters in the aftermath of the First World War, became highly disillusioned and started moving completely away from the work in writing a poem like If, for instance. And Wells, likewise, in his later texts, Things to Come, would also sort of start looking at the challenges that humanity would go through, a sort of ongoing war within that. And I talked about the growth of spiritualism. You could also argue that one of the aspects of Victorian Britain in particular was a huge amount of hypocrisy. It was a very, very patriarchal society. At the end of the day, the father was in charge. You know, God's in his castle, the king's in his palace, or in this case, obviously, Queen Victoria. Again, the slight sort of irony there. The man is running his household. Likewise, as I say, spiritualism also there. Fears and prejudices were also happening. If you look at some of the other areas that I haven't mentioned, because it's slightly beyond the remit of this particular talk, Bram Stoker writes Dracula, similar sort of time, late 19th century. Dracula, as the writer Edward Said actually talks about, is very much a commentary on Orientalism, this fear of the unknown. And the multiculturalism that sort of impacted the empire from people, particularly in port areas, from London, from Liverpool, from Bristol and so on, where you actually get a whole range of input and different sort of cultures occurring, also tap in regressively to not only fear of the unknown, but also prejudgments, prejudices, and lines with respect to that. It's impossible to sympathise or empathise with the Martians, really, because they just come in their tripods, they construct those, and they just blast everything. Maybe, again, that's quite a deliberate sort of aspect. Now, in The Time Machine, we have the evolutionary fable of how the Morlocks and the Eloi are effectively seen as the two sort of final aspects of Wells' work and so on. And you can probably, again, appreciate some of the elements of the Morlocks if, from the benefit of the year 2017, you look at some of those sequels produced by Stephen Baxter, who's also done a sequel published this year, actually, to The War of the Worlds. You know, again, this whole notion of how things develop, what happens if they reinvade, and so on. In other words, can we also say that War of the Worlds transcends its initial limitations of being a serialized form into a cultural icon? Well, I'm going to say yes, but I'm going to actually justify that a little bit by saying that in addition to Stephen Baxter's recent work, there are a whole range of sort of other additional elements that come through in terms of War of the Worlds movies, prophetic fiction, elements relating to a series by Marvel Comics in the 1970s by, called Killraven, War of the Worlds, and TV series, War of the Worlds movies, lots of sort of elements within that. There's something in terms of, you know, the very notion of it, even if you're not familiar with the tripods and the structures and the elements within that, that kind of relate to what Wells tapped into. And to a certain extent, although the theory and the thesis that science fiction was all about getting it right, it was all about predictions, it's all about prophecies, it's changed slightly, because actually, if you did a rigorous analysis, science fiction gets it wrong far more than it gets it right. It's just that sometimes, in the case of communication satellites and genetic engineering, when it gets it right, it tends to resonate. But very, very few writers were suggesting that the tablet and the other devices would be so ubiquitous. By this stage, if you look at writings in the 1960s, 1970s, we effectively would have had a fully fledged moon base, so we would have already landed on Mars, and so on and so forth. That may still come, but, you know, in terms of prophesizing when, and if you are ever tempted to write some science fiction, I would always say keep your dates fairly general, don't be specific. 1984, reversal 1948, being just one example of where things perhaps don't necessarily map out, or maybe they do. But you could also argue, from a cultural theory perspective, that actually somehow the battles between the Axis superpowers, or the Kaiser, and the Allies and so on, in both World War I, officially referred to as the Great War, before World War II emerged, and the ongoing aspect of warfare, is on one level addressing the whole notion of natural selection. Because it's actually, you know, different species fighting and all sorts of other areas, not different species, different races fighting, different cultures fighting and so on, all seeking dominance. There is a suggestion, actually, that you can trace Darwinism to being responsible not only for extreme communism, but also extreme fascism, in terms of lines in which things were being developed. Again, time prohibits me from going into the works of Nietzsche and so on. But equally, from a science point of view, an awful lot of technological improvements emerge out of warfare. Going way back to the longbow, or the longbows used by King Henry V's men in Agincourt, as actually sort of having an impact. So the more technology you've actually got, and clearly, you know, culminating arguably in the use of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki explosions of the atom bomb in 1945, you know, the bigger the stick, the more that's been developed, the more it kind of impacts in terms of culturally what spin-offs emerge and so on. Is it influential? I'm going to say yes. From the perspective of, yes, it still sort of impacts in terms of what elements we actually see present. And to go right the way back to that whole notion of the analysis of proto-science fiction, if you see proto as being the first, or the prototype, you know, that initial first scenario, I think looked at from that perspective, we see in Wells's work not only elements of all of the areas I've spoken about this morning, but also the general sort of line of a writer who's, you know, exploring his own philosophies and working his way out, but also a cracking science fiction tale. Thanks for your time. I might see some of you anon as you proceed through your courses at university. Make sure you've signed the register, and I will hopefully be putting this up as a podcast as well later.